Hi there. Welcome to the From Lab to Launch podcast by Qualio, where we share inspiring stories from the people on the front lines of life sciences. Tune in and leave inspired to bring your life-saving products to the world.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for joining the show today. I'm Kelly from Qualio, and I'm your host here at From Lab to Launch. If you haven't already, please subscribe and give us a review on Apple or Spotify. We'd love that. If you want to be on the show, please see the application linked in the show notes. We've had a lot of people reach out, and it's been a pleasure to connect with you. Today, we have Lynn Yaffe joining us. Lynn is the co-founder, chairman, and CEO of EPR Technologies. EPR Technologies is a biomedical spinoff of the CEFR Center for Resuscitation Research, University of Pittsburgh. EPR Technologies is committed to the preservation of human life through rapid, profound hypothermia by pursuing techniques and patented products for emergency preservation and resuscitation to save a life when standard cardiopulmonary resuscitation fails. In the past decade, Lynn has been actively involved in research and development programs related to patient causality monitoring strategies, emergency hypothermia, and rapid cooling techniques for point-of-injury care to induce ultra-profound cooling and temporary suspended animation, or EPR, and semi-automated to automated rapid vessel access techniques and placement technologies. Let's bring him in. Hi, Lynn. Thanks for joining us today.
Hi, it's my pleasure. Nice to be here.
We love hearing about people's backgrounds, and you have a really impressive one. Attending Johns Hopkins University, University of Maryland School of Medicine, Columbia University, and additional molecular biology research experience at the Roche Institute of Molecular Biology. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, I've always was interested in research, particularly medical research. And in my last year of high school in Baltimore, where I grew up, I was at the Rosewood Hospital working in a laboratory doing different things with, you know, mice and rats, various things. And then when I went to Johns Hopkins, I majored in biophysics. And during those years, I continued to work at the Rosewood Hospital. And when I graduated, or before I graduated, I had early admission to the University of Maryland School of Medicine, and I went there and also continued when time permitted to work in a laboratory there at the University of Maryland. And then my interest for postgraduate training was in pathology. And so I went to Columbia University and worked there in pathology. And at the same time, as time permitted, I would cross the river through the Holland Tunnel and go to Hoffman-LaRoche. At the time, they had sort of an independent institution called the Roche Institute of Molecular Biology. And I worked there on B-cell, B-lymphocyte responses using mice B-cell tumors. And eventually, because I had obligated service at the end of Vietnam, it was called the Berry Plan under, I think, a Senator Berry, that you were permitted to finish all of your medical and residency training without being drafted. And if you signed up for that, of course, you obligated yourself to 4 years of service. So I signed up for that. And it was sort of shortly after I signed, the Vietnam War came to an end. But I had 4 years of obligated service. And I stayed at Columbia University and the Roche Institute, you know, beyond 4 years of residency training. And eventually the Navy said, you have to pay us your 4 years. So I asked where I could do research. And at the time, the strongest possibility was at the U.S. Naval Research Institute, which was in Bethesda across from NIH, which is now the Walter Reed National Naval Medical Center. And the laboratories have, you know, been rebuilt at other locations. But at the time, it was on that campus, and I worked there in combat casualty care-related research, blood research. I had to, you know, spend some time at the Pentagon in the medical office there under the Director of Defense Research and Engineering. I spent time at the Bureau of Medicine in the Department of the Navy and went back to the lab, Navy lab. And at one time, I controlled tens of millions of dollars in Navy research money, medical research money that went to different Navy medical research labs and also to universities and companies. I was called a beltway sailor, which means I spent my entire Navy time within the Washington Beltway and was never really at sea, though I visited many Navy ships when they were in port just to see what the medical setup was. And so in my career in the Navy in combat casualty care, there was always a major interest in how to save the lives of combat casualties who were killed in action. And because of that interest, I came in touch with Dr. Saffer. Now, Dr. Saffer, who died in 2003, he's considered the father of CPR, the father of cardiopulmonary resuscitation. It wasn't really a viable technique until he invented, together with an associate of his, James Elam, mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And Dr. Saffer really introduced that and joined it together with chest compressions. And he wrote the first book called The ABCs of Emergency Medicine, A being airway, being open, breathing meaning mouth to mouth, and C meaning chest compressions or establish a good circulation. And then he, you know, went around the world and is indirectly responsible for saving hundreds of thousands of lives because he popularized CPR. A lot of people don't realize that, but that occurred in the 1956, 1957, 1958. So it's really only since the early 1960s that CPR has been done. Dr. Saffer, it's also interesting history. He was a very great individual. He was nominated several times for the Nobel Prize, never won, but obviously being nominated is quite an accomplishment. He started the first paramedic service in the world because prior to CPR being a technique, paramedics didn't really exist. They were essentially ambulance drivers. You know, they couldn't do any cardiopulmonary resuscitation. It wasn't available. So he took a group of unemployed African-Americans in Pittsburgh, where he was at the time, and he trained them to be paramedics. He trained them to administer CPR, and it was called Freedom House. And it was really the first paramedic service in the world. And he took African-Americans to do that because white ambulance drivers, you know, in the early 60s, they wouldn't go into African-American neighborhoods in Pittsburgh and probably in most major cities in the U.S. And so now then with the Freedom House, they had their own paramedic service, which he ran together with his protege at the time, whose name was Nancy Caroline. And she, after her training in Freedom House, she went to Israel and started the equivalents of the American Red Cross Emergency Service and Paramedic Service in Israel. She, unfortunately, is deceased as well. But Peter Saffer had an interesting career. You know, eventually Freedom House was taken over by the city, and the African Americans were slowly eliminated from the service. And it became an all-white paramedic service back in the early 60s. That was the, you know, the way things happened, unfortunately, in those days. But Hollywood documentary was made about Freedom House, and it's not available to stream. At least I haven't seen it on Netflix or Amazon Prime, but I've seen it at Pittsburgh. And so his career was very interesting. He also started the first independent department of anesthesiology. Before that, anesthesiologists really were in the departments of surgery. And he was at Johns Hopkins in the late 50s, and when he was working on mouth-to-mouth resuscitation, and he asked if he could start an independent department of anesthesiology. Having an independent department is important for research purposes. You know, you sort of control your own destiny. And Hopkins said no at the time, but he had friends at Pittsburgh. So he went to Pittsburgh and started the anesthesiology department there. He was subsequently, you know, did everything he did in resuscitation and disaster management. And he started at Pittsburgh, the International Institute of Resuscitation. And now it's been named after him. It's the Saffer Center for Resuscitation Research. And he obviously had a very interesting career. After the Vietnam War, he, Dr. Saffer, and a Colonel Bellamy got together to see what could be done about combat casualties who were killed in action in Vietnam, because they recognized that if you look at those killed in action without head injury. Those who died, killed in action without head injury, 80% of them died from rapid bleeding, exsanguination. So there wasn't any time to save their lives. So then Peter Saffer principally came up with the idea. At the time, he called it sort of temporary suspended animation. It's not true suspended animation, but in the medical published literature, in those early days, he referred to it as suspended animation. And so as time went forward, a lot of research was done in large animals, particularly pigs. And they demonstrated that you could hemorrhage, obviously under anesthesia. You could do surgical trauma, let them bleed out rapidly or slowly to the point where the animals went into cardiac arrest. You could rapidly cool them down, and I'll explain more about that. And then when they're in a cold state, meaning 5 to 15 degrees centigrade or 41 to 59 degrees Fahrenheit, their body is in such a low metabolic state that oxygen is not needed. So it buys time for surgical intervention. So essentially, it's a temporary suspended animation. I mean, 3 hours is about the time for transport and surgical repairs, which what they would do on the animals. And eventually, a company was formed based on the techniques. And eventually, the FDA approved a limited clinical trial, which is ongoing now. It has been on pause because of the COVID pandemic. So much was required to deal with patients in the ICU. COVID patients who were having tremendous respiratory difficulties were put on extracorporeal membrane oxygenation, an external sort of lung that required blood to prime that. And our EPR procedures, when you rewarm the patient to resuscitate them after surgical repairs, of course, you have to give them blood back. Because during the cooling phase, the blood is flushed out with ice cold saline. So our procedures are intensive as well. So it was put on pause, but they're getting ready now to hopefully restart the clinical trial. Hopefully they're not going to have a peak of COVID patients again, though there seemed to be an increase in infections there. At least for immunized people, it's not particularly serious. So the company was formed. As I said, Dr. Saffer died in 2003, and all of the people who worked with him, myself included, we formed a company and got to the point where a clinical trial was granted. We changed the name of the procedure from suspended animation or temporary suspended animation because it sounded too much like science fiction.
Yeah.
And so it was suggested to call it emergency preservation and resuscitation, EPR. So it was like when CPR fails, then you induce EPR. So we wanted a sort of letter a phrase, but emergency preservation, that's the cool down phase. And then after surgical repairs, rewarming and resuscitation is really delayed resuscitation. The primary resuscitation is delayed. And so, you know, that's the basis of things. You know, life-threatening trauma where victims die, there are about, let's say, 500 cases a day in the United States, at least before the pandemic occurred. I mean, since the pandemic, I guess there may be a little less trauma because there's less driving, perhaps. Though it's probably picking up again, people were staying at home. And there are about 1,500 cases of sudden cardiac arrest, severe heart attack, where people can't be resuscitated. Now, exsanguination cardiac arrest, meaning bleeding to the point of cardiac arrest, if that happens to you from an accident or a gunshot wound, you know, a mass shooting incident, your chances of surviving are less than 5%, even if you go to the best university center in the U.S., it's a very poor survival rate because you can't get to the patient fast enough to stop the bleeding or give blood. So in those situations, EPR could be invaluable. For sudden cardiac arrest, if you have sudden cardiac arrest or severe heart attack that requires resuscitation outside of a hospital setting, meaning at home or at work, your chances of surviving are maybe 15 to 20% that CPR will get you resuscitated. In a hospital, it's better. It's 30 to 40% that they'll get you resuscitated, obviously, because they're there with all the equipment right away. But right, still, right. The statistics for surviving CPR are very, very. And so I think EPR, you know, when you talk about 2,000 people a day in the U.S. alone, this could be attempted if the situation is right. I'm not saying it'll be attempted in everyone, but certainly in a significant number of cases, there's a good chance. And, you know, there's strong anecdotal evidence that this will work, aside from the animal research, which is extensive, and it obviously works in animals. We've all heard of cases where skiers have been caught in an avalanche. Now, those are healthy individuals. They cool down so rapidly that when they're dug out, they appear to be dead. There's no breathing. There's no heart function, just like in EPR. And then they rapidly rewarm those patients. You know, they get them, fly them out by a helicopter or something. And then there are some cases where those people are resuscitated and survive. Not all of them, but it's anecdotal evidence that being cooled down to, you know, 10 degrees Celsius, 41 degrees or so Fahrenheit in and of itself is not going to kill you. It's the prolonged period. I mean, you can't go for, you know, days in that state. You need oxygen. But for a few hours, you don't need oxygen because your metabolic requirements are almost zero. And then there are cases where children or adults have fallen on, you know, through ice on a frozen lake. They also cool down very quickly. And if they can be rescued, they can be rewarmed. So there's strong anecdotal evidence. And also in serious neurovascular surgery, they frequently will cool the patient down, not to profound temperatures that we use in EPR, but into deep hypothermia, which is above, you know, it's mild, deep, profound, ultra. And I can explain some of this. But there, in a controlled situation, they'll cool the patient down while they're put on cardiopulmonary bypass to perform difficult neurovascular surgery. So, you know, overall in medicine, it's called therapeutic hypothermia and temperature management. Mild is used in severe heart attacks where the patient is resuscitated, but cooling them down just a couple of degrees takes the burden off of recovery and is sort of neuroprotective. You can't go much lower than a few degrees because your heart will stop beating. Obviously, we go to that low temperature of ultra profound or profound hypothermia to ultra profound using ice cold saline. So that's essentially the story. All started by Peter Saffer, continued by the people who work with him, clinical trial ongoing. And that's what we're all dedicated to getting this to the point where it works. I mean, I guess the company wants to make money in order to do second and third generation products. And ultimately, when this is done at trauma centers and then hospital emergency rooms and possibly on the floors, the way they're crash carts, we want to, as quickly as possible, get it out to paramedics, which will require, I'll just say, semi-automated equipment to make it easier and faster to do. So you don't have a team of, you know, eight surgeons there trying to get it done. You might have two paramedics. And so, you know, we've got plans for all of that, how to do that.
Yeah, I was going to say the portability. I was thinking about this as you were speaking, you know, the portability of the technology would be the challenge to solve, I think.
Portability is a challenge because to cool down an adult, you need to have available, let's say, 30 liters of ice cold saline.
Right.
In the future, we'll probably have some additives, but, you know, for the initial clinical trial, it's sort of proof principle. But there's some additives that would add some neuroprotection during the cool down, that sort of thing. But it's possible for an ambulance or a medevac helicopter to have 30 liters of solution sort of at their parking spot, you know, where they back into an emergency that is plugged in and kept cold. And then all they have to do is grab a container that'll stay cold for their, 10-minute drive to wherever they have to go. So there is portability there. And of course, ambulances have electricity. So theoretically, you could have a small refrigerator to hold the fluid on board. And, they could just take 20 liters of it. It could be in 10-liter bags. And then you need the vascular access. How do you pump in that solution? That's where semi-automation comes. I won't go into all the details, but, you don't want the paramedics in a patient who's been shot or traumatized in some way is bleeding out. You don't want them spending 10 or 15 minutes trying to access an artery. You want to be able to do it like that, or to have them access it before the patient goes into cardiac arrest, or while they're doing CPR, access the artery. Clearly, if someone needs CPR for whatever reason, you must have good CPR until EPR is starting. You can't say, well, the person's not responding to CPR, and then take 10 minutes to do EPR and you don't do CPR because they need oxygen until they're cooled down. So you have to do good, bystander, good paramedic CPR while you're ready to do EPR. And then EPR, as soon as you start the flow, you get the brain cooled down within 5 minutes by a rapid flow. And of course, you have to take care of where does the blood flow out of. So we've got plans for that. In a trauma victim, the blood is already flowing out. So, if you're on the street, it'll, flow somewhere. Otherwise, you have sort of a cocoon plan where, you can collect the blood. You don't want to have a flood of blood and ice cold saline in an ambulance setting. So, those things are essentially easily solved. Everything has to be FDA approved, of course. But, this is going to happen in the future. The company is one thing. We want to be successful. But this is a medical advance, saving lives. So it's going to happen. It's just like, there's a constant yearly flood of new cancer drugs. Now it's augmenting the immune response, educating one's T cells to fight their tumor, plus messenger RNA, which everyone knows about because of COVID. But messenger RNA was originally looked at as a way of augmenting your fight against cancer. So that's not stopping, even though cancer hasn't been cured, obviously, in all cases. The same with failed CPR, EPR. It's just going to get better and better as time goes on. So, we're dedicated for the long run.
That's exciting. That's exciting technology.
It is very exciting. It's very exciting to be a part of it.
Definitely. Well, I guess, we kind of hit on a lot of the things I was thinking of asking you about as far as, what did COVID, obviously COVID interrupted a lot of clinical trials.
Yeah, COVID,
for a lot of folks.
Aside from the loss of lives with COVID, I should say that the January, what is it now? January 2020, I can't keep track of
I know.
Before COVID got started, it was just to be identified in the U.S., I had two visitors from China. They came and they visited the Safra Center. They visited me. I took them to Maryland Shock Trauma, where the clinical trial is being done. They met Sam Tischerman, the trauma surgeon who's leading the clinical trial. They met the chief trauma surgeon and director of Maryland Shock Trauma. His name is Thomas. They were very impressed that he had a plaque from the Chinese government on his bookshelf because he had led a trauma team to China when they had, I forget the year, when they had a serious earthquake there and a lot of trauma victims. And so he's been to China many times. They were very impressed with that. And they are very impressed with EPR. And, we were negotiating a sizable infusion of money, here for the U.S. effort and to do some things jointly in China. Obviously, they're interested in EPR. And then the two visitors, they had trouble getting back to China because of flight problems with COVID. And so I think they were in California for a couple of weeks till they got back. And then COVID has made it difficult to really complete an agreement, though they're very interested. They keep in touch with me and, the investors there in Shanghai, they're all on lockdown. now. But I think as COVID, hopefully sooner than later, gets behind us, we'll get some investment from China. But we've ramped up our efforts here because of the ongoing clinical trial. You know, we've started a crowdfunding campaign via Start Engine, startengine.com. They're a premier crowdfunding organization. They do a number of industries, including healthcare-related stuff. And so we thought that would be a start to generate interest. Podcasts has generated interest. We have a number of small investors, you know, the general, you know, they can put in just $200, and we've had about 80 people who have been invested small amounts of money, which is gratifying. The larger investors, they sort of wait to watch what happens. And we're also talking with some family foundations who are very interested, and also some well-heeled investment type are watching what we're doing and talking to us. So I think it's only a matter of a little bit of time and we'll have some U.S. investment. And, you know, people are very cautious. It's a big step. There are risks associated with EPR as there are with every medical advance. So, you know, one can never make guarantees to an investor. The only thing I can guarantee is that we're going to be dedicated to this and we're going to be persistent and eventually things will happen. I just can't put a date on it, of course.
That is the hard part.
Yes.
That is the hard part too. Well, so in a career that started off, you know, in Navy and trauma all the way to now still pursuing things in the public sector, although I assume the military is still incredibly interested in.
Well, the military funded all of the research and they're funding the clinical trial.
Yeah.
And so the U.S. Army, primarily a little bit from the Navy, but the U.S. Army has been tremendous supporters of this. They have put in over the years about $17.75 million. So they're dedicated to this. I mean, right now, it's the only possibility for saving those killed in action, whether you look at Vietnam, whether you look at Afghanistan, whether you look at Iraq, those U.S. Military killed in action without a head injury. Obviously, if your head's blown off, there's not much you can do. There's nothing you can do. But those who are killed in action based on their traumatic injuries and bleeding, there's still nothing that can be done. And so they remain interested in EPR. Obviously, the military's gotten much, much better in combat casualty survival when it comes to limbs and injuries, but rapid exsanguination, there's very little they can do. And so the hope is held that EPR will provide a technique to help to save additional lives in the future, if necessary.
That would be absolutely amazing. Absolutely. Well, where can people go to learn more, follow along, and connect with you?
Well, we have a website and, of course, our crowdfunding site. Could I hold up a little sign? Because it's a sort of a mouthful of
we'll post there you go.
www.startengine.com, EPR-technologies. I guess it can be read correct. And www.epr-technologies.com. We are also at EPR Technology. At www.epr-technology.com, as well as Referral Technologies.
Okay.
So
perfect. And we'll make sure that's all linked in our show notes as well.
I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
And there's a lot of information on the crowdfunding. There are a lot of videos that are they can look at. You know, it'll take them to YouTube. And there's a lot of source material because they're very careful about due diligence and compliance. So, you know, I can't say that, you know, 500 people a year, or rather 500 people a day are affected with severe trauma. They need a source for that. So
know,
I give them all of the scientific literature for that.
So, absolutely.
Everything is authenticated. So
perfect.
And then our bios are on there as well. And as required by the Security and Exchange Commission that oversees this crowdfunding, so all of the potential risks are mentioned as well. I try to frequently put in updates, you know, with historical information and more details about the clinical trial. So it's a lot of reading, but hopefully people will find it interesting and not too heavy. You know, keep the science at a bit of a minimum.
Sure, sure. Well, it's just a fascinating history that you talked about.
It absolutely is.
From CPR to EPR and how that all came about, you know, those of us who, you know, did the CPR certifications when we were kids so we could babysit, I had no idea that it just hadn't always been a thing.
Yes. CPR is taught more and more in schools. And I think particularly high school and college students, they should all get certified during CPR. You know, an interesting side note, the mannequins that people practice on, you know, the little mouth-to-mouth and mannequins and the chest compression mannequins, that the first CPR mannequin was really produced on the behest of Dr. Saffer. Back in the 60s, he met Lærdal in Norway. And at the time, Lærdal was a doll manufacturer. As far as I can recall, they made a doll that when you put it to sleep, the eyes would close.
Yeah.
So they made a mannequin and it was called Resusa Annie. And if you look up Resusa Annie, there's a museum about it, I think. And the face of Resusa Annie is a death mask that was made of a young woman who committed suicide by jumping into the Seine River in Paris. Mm. So they just chose that. And now, so Peter Saffer was involved in that too. Now Lærdal, they don't make dolls anymore. They make defibrillators and other medical equipment. They make resuscitation mannequins, as well as full computer-controlled, AI-controlled mannequins that present symptoms to medical students for training. You know, very expensive mannequins. You know, they can cost $250,000. And most medical schools have centers for simulation now. And I think that Lærdal even makes a small mannequin, you know, sort of upper chest and head to teach elementary school children what resuscitation is about. Obviously, they're not going to do it, but it introduced them early on to the idea. And they go home and talk to their parents about it and, you know, get their parents to think about getting certified in CPR. It's something particularly that every new mother should do. Just in case her infant gets into a problem. Definitely. It's very important.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Lynn. I really appreciate that dive into your technology and super excited to see how that one turns out.
I appreciate you giving me the time to go on for so long.
Absolutely. All right. Well, thanks again. And it's been a pleasure. Have a great one. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this week's episode of From Lab to Launch, brought to you by Qualio. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and give the show a positive review. It really helps us out. For more information about Qualio, our guest today, or to be a guest on a future episode, please refer to the show notes. Until next time.